Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Janina Terzi. Janina is co-founder of the Lancaster Farm Sanctuary, a doctor of physical therapy and a yoga educator. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 77 others. So don't forget to run through that back catalogue if you've just found us. There's a fascinating range of conversations. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend or two helps us nudge more people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates or search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Janina. How are you?
Hi, Jamie. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have the chance to talk to you. We've spoken online and texted in our groups before, so it's great to have as close to an in-person conversation as we'll get. And it's great to have you join this series of sentientist conversations. And as you know already, really it's about the two deepest philosophical questions, the ones I think are the most important. What's real? How should we understand the world around us? And what matters morally? How should we set our scope of moral consideration, if you like? What should we care about and who should we care about? But in these conversations, I'm talking to people who both agree with and disagree with this philosophy that I'm trying to popularize called sentientism, which says when it comes to thinking about what's real, we should take a naturalistic approach based on evidence and reason. And when it comes to setting our moral scope of consideration, the clue is in the name, we should use sentience, the capacity to have experiences of suffering and flourishing. And you know, essentially any being that has the capacity to suffer, we should have compassion for and moral consideration for. But as I said, I'm talking to people who agree and disagree with it. So it'd be fascinating to understand your own philosophical journey and where you are now. But before we get on to those two questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work?
Well, my name is Janina Terzi. So I am one of the co-founders of Lancaster Farm Sanctuary. My partner Sarah and I founded a farmed animal sanctuary in Pennsylvania. So a few years ago, 4 years ago. And so as a founder of a farmed animal sanctuary, that's one of the main ways I have found and loved your podcast and this conversation that you've been having with so many. I'm also a physical therapist. I think in Britain, you call them physiotherapists. So yeah, that's what I did prior to finding animal activism primarily. And some of these conversations were born for me in wanting first to help humans feel better in their bodies. So my background as a PT is definitely relevant in this chat. And yeah, I am a queer person. And I have chosen a path of sobriety. I didn't have necessarily drugs or alcohol and addiction myself, but I have found that sobriety was also very helpful in wanting to practice activism for others. So those are some of the threads I find relevant, hopefully, in this chat.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it's great to have a flavor of who you are, and we're going to dig into your philosophical journey now a little bit more too. So the first of those two fundamental questions we like to ask is, what's real? So for many of my guests, that's a story about winding the clock back and talking about how they grew up originally. Was that in a more religious, spiritual, mystical context, or was it one that was already quite naturalistic or physicalist, if you like? Maybe atheist or agnostic, and how that side of their philosophy about what's real, the nature of the universe, has shifted over time and where they've got to now. So yeah, it would be fascinating to know your personal story.
Yeah, thanks. So I was raised by kind of hippie parents. My mom and dad were definitely of that generation that came to really appreciate civil rights and social justice. It was something strong in my household and sort of that very global open-minded type of household. But my dad went to Catholic school, and I was raised to go to Catholic church, including Sunday school, and go all the way through the confirmation process. But all along, my dad said to me, you're just doing this as part of a, you know, cultural sort of appreciation for what his mother, my grandmother, believed. So it was like we would go to church with her, we would have a family ritual around that practice. But my dad would say things to me like, yeah, I really don't understand why we would cut down trees to build a church. So sort of a natural appreciation and a very, again, hippie mindset was my dad. My mom is, a granddaughter of a Brethren preacher. Brethren is a type of very conservative Christian. Where I live in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of Amish and Mennonite religion around me. And Brethren is a slightly more liberal part of that lineage. So she also had gone far from buying into those religious doctrines. But still, that was that idealism, this idea of a perfect union with God and creation was in her heart as well. So I feel like I was raised by people who really had a great spiritual appreciation, but maybe didn't buy into the religious doctrines that they were raised in. And I so appreciate that they gave me that freedom from day one to just question religion. And it never felt powerful to me in church. I always felt my sense of the world and what was real and what was going on in me and around me felt most alive outside of church services, for sure.
Yeah. So it sounds like there was openness, a sense of compassion, sense of connectedness with other humans, certainly, and respect for as your father said, just the sort of cultural traditions and being part of the community and being part of the rituals and the practices in that context. If you can remember back, did it translate through to you actually believing any of the supernatural stuff you were learning in Catholic school or church? Or was it always purely a cultural thing and this is just something we're doing and I don't really believe what these stories about deities and heaven and hell? And
so it never really translated for me. There was nothing in this text that felt to me like it was a divine law or some sort of prophesized truth. To me, it felt like a human construct. I had heard, probably my dad even told me, that the Bible was written several hundred years after Jesus had lived. So these figures were more like historical to me, but the ideas had great value. At no point did a sense of creator God, like a singular omnipotent or omnipowerful creator head God, ever feel real to me. I remember identifying as atheist as a teenager. I actually was in an anatomy course. So when I started studying human anatomy, I had sort of what I think of as a first spiritual revelation for myself, studying in particular the human kidney. And I was looking at the system of how our body gets water from what we eat. And I thought, this is so beautiful and elegant. And for me, that felt spiritual in a way that it gave me great purpose and a dedication and something I wanted to serve. For my whole life, I could feel this, you know, passion inside me that I wanted to be in service of many people, I don't know, retain water, but feel better in their body. But at no point did that really feel like the creator God.
Yeah, makes sense. And I'm guessing that it never really felt like you sort of left Catholicism. It wasn't really a thing you needed to do. Maybe it just drifted away and you started to identify more naturally as an atheist and think in different ways. Some of my other guests have had quite difficult or traumatic experiences of leaving religion because of societal or, you know, psychological challenges, but I'm guessing you didn't really feel that. It was more just a drift.
Yeah, it was quite easy, actually. Again, going back to my grandmother, who I'm named for, so she was quite a central figure as I was growing up. I remember telling her I didn't want to continue going to masses with her as often. I think she was disappointed, but she just said, I want you to be happy, you know. And that, I think that was what I was so trying to speak to and appreciate, that my parents, I feel like they were teaching me a little bit about sentientism by saying, we're doing this thing with her because it matters to her. She's our sentient elder and we care. Yeah. She cared that I became confirmed. It's sort of a Catholic ritual. But when I said it wasn't something I wanted to pursue further, she continued to love me, and that meant so much. I'm very lucky. I know that was a privilege that not everyone has.
Yeah. And we'll come back to digging into the sort of moral side of this, but one part of the journey people find in moving away from a religious worldview is about the morality as well. Well, it sounds like you just didn't find it particularly intellectually compelling, and you recognized it as a historical, human-created set of stories, if you like. But some people also see some of the ethics that are pushed through those processes, and that's another reason for them rejecting. Did you experience any problematic ethics, or was it much more just about open compassion, loving each other, and all the good stuff?
A little bit of both. Another very formative experience for me, again, where I'm raised, there weren't even many Catholic families in my school. There were some, but it was very homogenous, very, you know, white, rural part of Pennsylvania. So we didn't really have a diverse, even array of practicing Christians. This type of Christianity was in my school, but even Catholicism was other. Many Jewish families, or zero like Muslim families. So, and I had this very formative experience when I was a kid. It was in fifth grade, where a bunch of girls who knew each other was actually from something called Youth for Christ. It's a very Christian after school program. I had this year where they were bullying me. I was ostracized. I was a young queer kid. I was doing things that were different. I was definitely struggling to find myself in the world. I was struggling.
Yeah.
So to have a group of Christian girls kind of gang up on me and do some, a little bit of physical stuff and just a lot of emotional harm, I'm still talking that through in therapy. So for me, there was that problematic ethic. I saw being a Christian did not mean you were more loving or compassionate. I also, I'm a feel and emotion type person. So sitting in Catholic services, I felt almost nothing. The standing, the kneeling, you sort of do this recitation where there's one point where you say, like, it is right to give thanks and praise. It's just so rote, and the rituals didn't light me up. And so as a person who is very, I think, emotional, extra sensitive in that way, I felt what I think people get from religious services, or some people do, I would feel more so just holding my grandmother's hand in that too, or taking a walk in the woods, et cetera.
Yeah, makes sense. So I guess you've moved away from what was never really an intellectual engagement with Catholicism. You identified as an atheist as a teenager, but at the same time, you've talked about feeling a sense of spirituality. And I know through your yoga practice and your work, you're very familiar with sort of Eastern philosophies and Eastern religions as well. So if you moved from that sort of cultural affinity with Catholicism, and then to identifying with atheism, how would you describe where you are now? Are there still elements of, if you like, the supernatural or the mystical, or is the spirituality and the connectedness you feel still quite naturalistic? And how would you describe, you know, how you feel about what's real and the nature of the universe now?
Yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention I'm a recovering yoga teacher. I joke when I say that. I've recently taken a break from teaching because there's a lot there. I really appreciate you pushing me to say it. I think I have no idea what's real in terms of, like, is it a natural or is it a mystical place that I hold? I feel like it's unknowable. Maybe that's the agnostic answer. It's unknowable. I'm quite comfortable. Maybe it's pragmatic. I'm quite comfortable. Someone, if we do a post about one of our residents here and we say, this sick goat, we send them your best. And someone says, oh, I'm praying for you, Joel. We have a little baby goat who's sick right now. And when people say, oh, I'm praying for you, Joel, I feel great. It makes my heart feel happy. I'm like, thank you. Yeah. It doesn't bother me. I'm quite comfortable with going into that framework if it helps the person feel loving and caring.
Yeah. They're thinking of your baby goat. They're caring. They're expressing that to you. What's not to like?
If it's not being used to other, to create an in-group or an out-group, I think that it can, there's a place for a spiritual framework where you say it's unknowable. I'm okay with capitalizing that from my yoga studies. I joke, I love the teachings of yoga. I've had trouble teaching yoga myself lately, but in the teachings of yoga, we have the capital letter S. So we have the lowercase self is our ego, our small self, the way that we would other someone or be uncaring or not practice nonviolence. And in yoga, the understanding I had or the way I was taught yoga to guide us towards our capital S self, our higher, more self-realized, true self, being very caring, understanding that we are one with all that is, and that to the extent that we harm others, we are literally harming ourselves. When you reach that place in the yoga journey, spiritual journey, they say that you are now the capital S self. And I'm like, okay, let's capitalize the unknowable, the capital U. I don't know. So I'm okay with capitalizing things. Fairly open to whatever language people have for moving towards oneness, moving towards interconnectedness in search of compassion for sentient beings.
Yeah, thank you. And I find this subject fascinating, and maybe some people find it annoying when you dig into this, right? Because maybe it doesn't necessarily make an enormous difference until we get through to how does this influence morality and ethics and decisions we make. But it does feel to me like there is a sort of sliding scale on a supernaturalism, naturalism thing. So some people are absolutely convinced that the most important thing in, you know, the world and reality is supernatural. There is a deity, or there is some ephemeral spirit, or there is something, you know, beyond what we can experience directly, or we can engage with scientific methods. So they're absolutely convinced there's something supernatural. And I don't accord with that view. Equally, there are people who are absolutely 100% convinced that there is no supernatural and that everything is natural and naturalistic, and everything in principle is explorable and detectable and understandable through scientific methods broadly understood. But I think there's an enormous range of possibilities in between those two extremes. And I'm personally, I'm quite close to the latter. I'm not absolutely convinced there's no supernatural. I think it's conceivable, but I will not choose to believe in its existence until there is any evidence. And in the absence of evidence, I will just not have a belief in the supernatural. So whether that's, you know, Father Christmas or fairies at the end of the garden or an ephemeral spirit or a god, I'm not 100% confident they don't exist. I always want to be technically open-minded, but until there's evidence there, I'm going to withhold my belief and I won't have that belief. So there's almost a difference between a methodological naturalism, which says I will base my beliefs on evidence and reason, but it's conceivable. There could be things for which we'll never find evidence that might still be true. I would never know how to explain them and describe them or know anything about them because there's no evidence, but they could still be out there. So I'm probably there. So I'm quite close to the hard naturalistic end, but I still think even a naturalistic worldview needs to be open-minded. Even crazy things have been proved to be true, and we should always have a provisional and probabilistic understanding of the world, not get trapped in our own version of the dogma where we're 100% confident that, you know, this scientific paper has the answer and I will brook no further evidence. So yeah, so it's interesting to understand where you are. I think you're probably a bit further along the spectrum than I am, but I think we're maybe both still broadly naturalistic.
Yeah,
I think open-minded naturalistic.
I do think there will always be something unknowable. And if I think far enough back in time, I'm not sure what the going theory is for what preceded the Big Bang. If you go far enough back in time or far enough to a small particle or a big particle, I feel like there will always be that further field of what's unknowable. Yeah. And I actually think there's some usefulness in holding that with a sacred reverence. I've heard you call it a sense of wonder and awe. And I'm like, that works. Like, it could be the word God, or it could be a sense of wonder and awe. As long as at that edge of what you don't know, you're open, like you're saying, learn, like you're coachable, teachable, learning new things. To me, that's a goal.
I think that's deeply important. Keeping just being comfortable not knowing. And for me, the best way of working out whether something's unknown or unknowable is to keep trying to find out. There may be things that are completely unknowable, or we might surprise ourselves. And I flick sometimes between, on the one hand, being just overawed at how much we have been able to find out, and whether it's because ultimately computation is universal and we've developed a level of intellect and capability that means we can do things that are way beyond what we evolved to do. And that gives me, on the one hand, a sort of optimistic sense of what more we might be able to understand. But on the flip side, we've got to remember that we're just another type of ape that evolved to roam the savannah, and that should give us some humility about what it might even be possible to understand. So I'm never quite sure which side of that to bat on.
Please, let's have a both and on that one. I don't think that it is possible for us to organize and achieve what we're capable of without that kind of humility and understanding. So
yeah.
In my mind, that's a clear both and.
Yeah, sounds good to me. So it'd be interesting to draw some connections now to the second big question of what matters morally, because some people think of these as separate topics. There's the epistemology, if you like, there's the what is, and then there's the ethics and the morality and the what ought we do and what's good and bad. But I quite like the fact they're linked, and quite often, I think for most people, they are linked. So people who come from a supernatural or a religious worldview, that's often critically part of the package. There's, here are the things you believe, but here's also a moral structure. Here's a list of rules in the Quran or the Bible. There's a deity that is a perfect instantiation of the good, and you have to echo that, replicate it. And also there's often a sort of sometimes pretty brutal justice system built into that as well. Whereas if you don't follow the right rules, you might burn in hell for eternity, which I still think is a pretty strange thing to tell to a child. Or you might get a perfect reward with an eternal life of bliss in heaven, right? So there's a superstructure that's there, and that varies radically across different supernatural philosophies, but it's important. And when you move away from those systems of thought, some people find that difficult because they feel like they're losing ethical moorings. And for other people, that supernatural stuff never really set the grounding of the morality anyway. So it's a pretty easy transition. So it would be interesting to understand, I guess, if someone said to you, okay, what is the basis of your morality? Why do you care about, or how do you decide what's good and bad? How would you answer that in the context of your philosophical journey?
Yeah, I would answer oneness. Since we are all interconnected in some way, and that's a tricky one to back up scientifically, but I feel that we are somehow connected to all other beings. I feel as though when you harm others, especially unnecessarily, if you're reckless about how you behave and the way your actions impact others, that in one way or another, whether it's your own conscience, your own psychology, your own cognitive dissonance, that you will ultimately be harmed. Or if there is a sense of cosmic, a jeweled web of interconnectedness, that could be there too. But for me, it's just the idea that we are connected. What you do to others will ultimately feel either just negatively or, again, this closer to mystical grooviness.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. The one word I call out in what you just described that particularly resonates with me is harm, and that sense of seeing harming others, particularly needlessly, as, I guess, the central ethical wrong. And to my mind, that links to this concept of sentience we're about to talk about, because in a way, the only entities you can harm are those that are sentient and have the capacity to experience the suffering as a result of it. So I think there's, with many of the conversations I'm having, that sort of centrality of suffering and harm is important. But there is also this layer of a sense of, you know, connectedness and webs of relationships, and the fact that people with a spiritual worldview might think of us being connected in some mystical way. And with my naturalistic worldview, I think of us being connected both in a physics sense, right? We are all stardust, but in an evolutionary sense, in that we share an evolutionary history, but also in, you know, the webs of collaboration and cooperation and dependency we have between ourselves as well. So I think, again, you can, whether you take a more spiritual or a more hard-edged naturalistic view, there's still some common elements, both in wanting to avoid harm to a sentient entity and also recognizing those webs of connectedness and how we're all part of some sort of superstructured system in a way.
Yeah. And the superstructure, you know, this, I've heard it called the relational field, this way that we might all be related on a mystical level. I hold that very lightly. It's something that makes me feel nice to think about. But I think very pragmatically, too, it hurt people. So the more, you know, recklessly we are harming each other here in this physical plane, watching systems, watching cultures, looking at how corrupt power and oppression and repression eventually comes out. So it serves all of us to try not to cause reckless harm. I don't know why that's such a hard sell.
Yeah, it should be a win-win. And it strikes me and this is a bit of a tangent, but it's just a lucky thing that our ability to have compassion and cooperate ultimately does seem to have been evolutionarily adaptive. So despite the fact that we still struggle to do it consistently, and that we're now intellectually trying to refine and clarify that sort of evolutionary basis, and that there is all sorts of awful stuff in evolution as well. There's tribalism and there's aggression and there's, you know, infanticide and so on. But there is at least a core there that demonstrates that as ultimately social beings and beings that are part of interconnected webs, that ability to appreciate that others exist, they have interests too, and cooperation often is better than striking out on your own, ultimately benefits the groups that do that. And I do think that's one, it's got a sort of some degree of adaptive truth, but then there's also a sort of ethical decision to care that we can layer onto that as well to reinforce it. But there's a second really important question beyond the, okay, what's the grounding of morality, which is this one, this critical one. And I think it's neglected in philosophy, which is, okay, what's our moral scope? Because you and I might, and your parents and almost everyone we know would recognize, we would all have some compassion, right? We would all care about others. We'll care about our immediate family. We'll care about people around us. We'll care about friends. And we may extend that broader and broader. But one of the central problems is when that compassion is either conditional, I will have compassion for you if you follow these rules, or if you do what I say, if you submit to my will, or it's constrained based on certain types of individuals. So that causes problems within the human species already with the, you know, unpleasant types of discrimination we already see even within humans. But then there's another boundary, which is considering, are humans the only entities that matter or not? So it would be really interesting to know your journey for how you thought that through. Again, you can go back to childhood if you like. How have you come to think about which entities in this massive universal system, which ones actually matter morally? And how do you draw that boundary?
I'm one of those people who actually thinks that plants might have a kind of sentience worth caring about. So for me, it's absolutely all sentient animals is like a given for me. It's so obvious. I've literally looked inside anatomically. My job as a PT, I'm putting my hands on people and their bodies, and I have felt that same movement in animals. The idea that they aren't sentient is so bizarre to me.
Yeah.
But I'm actually not I'm fairly comfortable saying we shouldn't cause unnecessary harm to plants. I mean, I am very comfortable, actually. So I don't know. I don't think it's sentient. I've looked it up. I'm like, what am I saying here? So an ability to move towards flourishing, a positive stimulus, or away from something that might harm you. And I've seen how plants grow in relation to the sun, or maybe it's just that simple growth movement. But for me, that's enough to care. That's just me. And of course, then, as I've heard you say so wonderfully, it also to the sentient beings for whom that plant's existence is their intrinsic values to them as well. So all of that, I'm okay with saying that we shouldn't harm plants unnecessarily. I'm a fan of them.
Yeah,
I don't know about rocks and mountains as a thought experiment. I try to like picture a barren planet space that has no sentient plants growing. I don't feel much moral concern there, but I'm open to holding that one as well. It doesn't feel quite as strong for me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's movement. Yeah, I think if an entity has the capacity to grow towards, and in the sense of a plant, it's very slowly, movement for an animal is so obvious. They're running away from harm. It's like, that's it. Let's care about that.
Yeah,
let's try to help them.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the odd things about the way I'm trying to frame sentientism is it doesn't actually tell us which entities are sentient. So different sentientists do disagree about where to draw the boundary. So there are some sentientists that are confident that, for example, bivalves and oysters aren't sentient. I'm personally confident that sea sponges aren't sentient because they don't have a brain or a nervous system. Personally, I would exclude plants based on my understanding of the science, but other sentientists would be more open-minded about whether plants might have some rudimentary level of experiencing as well. I don't see any evidence for that at the moment. Interestingly, there are also sentientists who will go even further than that. So I had a fascinating conversation with Luke Roloffs recently, who's a panpsychist. So he thinks that, again, in a very rudimentary sense, you could argue that almost everything, even elementary particles, you know, themselves, have some degree of subjective experience. Again, it's not a view I hold. And it's interesting that he comes back to practically a scope of moral consideration that I think is very similar to yours and mine, which still prioritizes sentient animals because of the nature of the sentience and the nature of the suffering they're likely to experience. So in practical terms, it tends to converge. But it's interesting. So you're focused on sentience, but maybe you have a broader, you know, estimation than I do personally of where that might be.
I think so, if I heard you right, maybe, because it's not just the structure of having a central nervous system, which I'm a huge fan of, but also the function and the behavior. So if you can see sea sponges, for example, maybe that's, and I love that this is how you frame it, that it's a question that you're not trying to tell everyone what to believe. But so if you see sea sponges move in any way towards or away from the stimulus they do or don't want, that's where I'm like, in their behavior, there's some, again, rudimentary as it may be, reason to support them if possible, if at all possible.
Yeah, makes sense. So how would you feel about a Roomba?
Oh, exactly. Well, so is there behavior that would indicate suffering when they're bouncing against the wall for minute 12? I don't know that they're suffering.
Desperately trying to find their charging port here.
I think maybe it is structure and function. So they're bouncing against the wall, but in the absence of nerve endings, maybe that doesn't hurt. I don't know.
Yeah. But I think this comes back to what we were talking about before, about needing to have an open-minded view naturalistically, a probabilistic view, even for other humans. I don't think we can be 100%. I'm not 100% sure you're sentient. I'm pretty confident you are. But for me, the evidence comes from three different sources. And when they all line up, that gives me even more confidence and pushes my probabilities higher. So one is the, you know, common evolutionary history, in that you can just see how certain pressures might have led for it to be useful for a biological being to build a model of itself, a model of the environment, a model of others, maybe develop a theory of mind, and to feel a sort of valence that would take it towards good things and away from bad things. So that links to your idea about function and movement and the need to survive and reproduce. So there's the biological path. There's behavior, you know, and again, it's only inference, really. We're not proving anything. It's inference. As we learn more about plants, there's more overlap between the slower plant behavior and animal behavior than you might have thought. So again, that might build some evidence there. But ultimately, for me, it does mostly come down to information processing architecture, because my personal philosophy of mind, and many other sentientists disagree, is that it's really just a class of information processing. So if you can examine the type of information processing that's going on in my mind when I experience consciousness, and we can find analogs for that elsewhere, again, that gives know, give some confidence that there's sentience out there as well. But it's all about probabilities, really. We're not proving these things one way or the other.
And I think what I do is let the word information mean different things in a way. I was hearing about mushrooms and their roots under the ground act as a kind of brain, the way that they have even been shown their roots can grow around a maze as though they have an intelligence, a capacity for sensation that is greater than just seeking the next nutrient. They can actually predict a wall and a boundary and go around an obstacle. So for me, I'm like, that's information processing in absence of neurons. I know how silly that can sound.
No, I totally agree that it is. And I think even the motion of an electron around an atom, in a sense, is information processing. It's all information processing. I guess the distinction really is, someone like Luke Roloffs would say, in a way, all information processing is, in some sense, conscious. And I would say consciousness and sentience is just a subset or a particular class of information processing that's evolved for a particular purpose. So that's the difference. But at the same time, on the one hand, my temptation when you talk about fungi or plants communicating will be to say, okay, they're just communicating, they're just sending messages, there's no subjective awareness. But at the same time, my subjective awareness is nothing but the firing of neurons and, you know, change of chemical firing as well, because my view is that there's no magic going on. It is just physical interaction. In a sense, maybe even my hard-edged naturalistic physicalist view comes back to having some affinity with other perspectives, because in a way it is just a type of information processing that's going on in my mind that gives me the sense that I'm aware. So
really humbling when you read the neurophysiological perspective on our mind versus our brain. It's humbling. It's your idea of your subject, you, your identity, is based on a cluster of firing neurons. And it's very mysterious how we go from these structural firing patterns to an individual I that is speaking and thinks it exists. So it is very mysterious. And who am I to say the fungi aren't doing that? But
yeah. And you touched on another interesting and important point, which is some people might think about needlessly causing harm to plants or trees or networks of fungi as ethically problematic because there's a possibility they might be sentient. And I would put that probability so low that really isn't an ethical concern for me. But it's still, you know, I still have to leave a little probability there. But there's another important reason, which is because those things are part of our environment and an ecosystem we're in. We can get aesthetic pleasure from looking at them. There are ecosystem services for us and other sentient beings. So I think there are a bunch of different ways why, whether you thought these things in the environment were sentient or not, you would still care about them instrumentally. So I think there's still quite a lot of overlap there. But one danger I find sometimes in the more expansive ways of thinking about ethical scope, and this can come through some Eastern philosophies, it can come through people who have this sense of connectedness and we are all one and we're all connected together. There's a risk there that while that feels quite generous and expansive, people will care genuinely about trees and rocks and rivers and plants in a way that goes beyond my sense of intrinsic worth. That by going so broad, there's a danger they sort of squash any distinctions and can get to the point where they lose the differentiation between cutting into a carrot and cutting the throat of a pig. And I find that deeply frustrating. And I've had some conversations with people along those lines where they'll say, everything is one. We are all part of a system. Life begets life. Life consumes life. As humans, we are part of that system. We must play our part. Give me a bacon sandwich. And there's a danger in that super holistic, ecocentric, systemic view that to me just enables us selfish humans to carry on oppressing in ways we always wanted. How do you avoid that trap? Because you clearly do in your philosophy.
Oh, Jamie, this is one of my very favorite things about your podcast. When you get to this part, this is my, I'm like, yes, I couldn't be more. So I have this term that it conjures for me, the concept of spiritual bypassing. That have you heard that term before?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you should look that one up. It's what you described so well. Spiritual bypassing.
Yeah.
A phenomenon very common in the yoga world where you're in such a rush to get to that integrated or, you know, capital S, this actualized divine true self state of understanding, that in a rush to get there, you are bypassing real time communication and relationship and nonviolence and ethics of caring for others. So if you're in such a rush to be the person who sees the sentience of plants that on the way you're willing to slit a pig's throat unnecessarily. You've missed the point. Let's go back to basics. It's really that's so well said by you so many times. And that's so the spiritual bypassing framework, you will hear about that in psychology as well. If spirituality is not just mystical, but also a purpose or a meaning to life, that someone could be in such a rush to do the same thing their father or grandfather did on their pig farm, that's in a way bypassing what humans need, which is to feel pride for the self and at a certain level to really not have to dissociate from our ethics. It's natural for us to care about causing unnecessary harm, and I would argue that it is. We have a conscience. We follow that evolutionarily, thank goodness. We are bypassing it. We're dissociating from it, another word psychologists would use, or dissociating, bypassing, avoiding with cognitive dissonance this fundamental issue that when we cause unnecessary harm, like we said, one way or another, this will come back to us. So it is so prevalent where I live. The Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or the county that I'm in, we have this very spiritual group who is also the factory farm owners, the farmers who are killing animals. I kid you not, on the road near where I live, there is a building that houses sentient beings. And on the side of the building facing the road, there's a Bible verse written. And it's a factory, it's a confined farmed animal feeding operation, a factory farm with a Bible verse written on it.
Dissonance is shocking.
Wild, yeah. So this idea that you can wrap yourself up in this, and in so doing bypass the opportunity to practice, I think the foundation of a spiritual practice is caring for others, the golden rule. It's so frustrating. And I so appreciate your work you're doing to try to bring light to it. I'm not sure if you're familiar with another framework for it. I think his name is Ken Wilber. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work. He's on the list of people I hope you'd interview. He said there's a measurable pathway of moral development for Erickson or some of the developmental psychologists, a given in watching a human being develop and having a mentally healthy progress through their life. You first see them be very egocentric, like a toddler, like this is mine, this is yours. Egocentrism is a healthy stage of our development. And then we get ethnocentric. Oh, this is my family. Or then later, this is my romantic partner. We have this belonging to a group. And that's a healthy stage that you go through as you're developing your peer group, your friends. But I think what you've given words to and what's happening now is our anthrocentrism, this stage we're in as a species where we see our species' needs as greater than the ecosystem around us, and an ability to like be very comfortable operating from anthrocentrism instead of a real ethic of caring for the world around us. I think it's the scariest thing happening. It's so terrifying to me. I see it all the time, and I'm not sure exactly how we're going to fix it, but I think it's one of the scariest things. People who are in the position, those of us with privilege and choice and access to make better choices for ourselves, for the animals, and for the planet now, the climate crisis that we're facing, and we're just not doing it. We're so capable of dwelling in that place of cognitive dissonance, and it is scary to me.
Yeah. And how did you go through that journey yourself with that critical boundary being going beyond the human? You dedicate most of your life now to looking after non-human sentience, but how was that journey for you? How early did that start? How difficult was it?
We always had cats and dogs in my household. My mom was a vegetarian and vegan for parts of my upbringing. In fact, I had this weird thing where I rebelled against vegetarianism because she told me I should do it. I was in a weird teenage angsty phase. But so it was really coming back to what I didn't understand about dairy. I had that myth of happy dairy cows and eggs and dairy weren't strong. I wasn't aware of dairy cows. It was like there was a hole in my brain where my vegetarianism was allowing me to avoid looking at that next.
And the marketing is relentless, right? It's presented as a sort of happy collaboration between species. And we both know it's so far from that.
And really, that hole was filled in by looking at slaughterhouse footage. Like I would have left the room previously, but it was with my partner, Sarah. Sarah's background was vegan in her upbringing and then lost away, but came back to it. So together, I feel like we like held each other's hands and looked at this footage and together filled in those holes and came back to something that was true for both of us in our lives that we had just forgotten and not committed to.
Yeah. And And just as we wrap up this stage, reflect on so many of these problems are really about the weirdness of human psychology and social psychology, because in both a Catholic upbringing, in the Eastern philosophies and religions that are centered around ahimsa, but even in a naturalistic worldview, there's so much of a drive for and potential for a universal compassion. But it seems that whatever the school of thought or whatever the philosophy is, there's just this drive from humans or this inertia from humans to keep dragging the moral scope back in and narrowing it, even within the human species, and certainly when we consider non-humans as well. So it's an ongoing frustration. But I guess I do have this sense that it's harder to do that if you genuinely take a naturalistic approach, because there isn't really any logical reason or any evidence that would undermine granting moral consideration to all beings that are capable of suffering. Anything that restricts that or constrains that, to my mind, is arbitrary and needs some other form of justification. But at the same time, it's very clear that many people who are, you know, absolutely determined to claim that they have a fully naturalistic worldview will believe complete fabrications about non-human animals and animal farming in particular. So even the most, you know, proud, strident, naturalistic, rational thinkers, you know, public intellectuals will believe that either non-human animals don't suffer or that animal farming doesn't cause suffering or various other myths. So it's really interesting that, again, because of human psychology, even people who are dedicated to a naturalistic, rational way of thinking often still have some sort of blind spot. And it might be a religious one, but non-human animal ethics is another absolute classic that I find deeply frustrating. Because you made the point earlier on, you hinted at the fact that not everybody has the time or the resources or the psychological energy or the emotional energy to do the hard moral work to work through these things. And we need to appreciate that and understand that context. But for people who do have the time and the resources and the capacity, and the, particularly when they're dedicated to a rational way of thinking and a moral way of thinking, I find the dissonance, you know, I struggle to accept it.
Absolutely. We're so deeply indoctrinated from such a young age that I think it so deeply wires us to hold separate animals, in particular animals farmed for food. And when we are encountering evidence that would challenge, it's so viscerally disturbing to think that we would have harmed them. When, you know, you see how a child interacts with an animal, they see a friend, and that's who we really are, I believe, or at least who we had the potential to sustain as who we are, as our clean slate child self. And then it's these layers of wounds and indoctrination, and it's so destabilizing to the healthy ego, not the one run amok, but the part of us that needs to know that we are okay, that we're not psychopaths or that we're not sociopaths. It's so destabilizing to confront evidence that we could have been part of the harm farmed animals experience, the suffering, the unimaginable amount of suffering that we've caused. Not all of us are ready to deal with that on Thursday at 10 a.m. It's a lot. You have to have safety, you have to have psychological safety. Some people, as you said, we're not all in the privileged position to even look at these issues, because our lives are still full of so much interpersonal drama. It's hard to get to that next step. But for those of us that by some miracle can, and then find creative ways. And that's, your podcast is so inviting. There's so little judgment. It doesn't come down as harsh or in criticism of people. Even when you're saying, oh, this is something that challenges you, you say, but why aren't philosophers better at looking at these issues? And I feel like that for almost everybody, for yoga teachers. Why aren't spiritual aspirants looking at these issues? Your way is so warm and inviting, because we all need to feel safe, and we need to have our fight or flight. Our nervous system needs to be in a state of calm. When we look at these things, we need someone to hold our hands, really, or just energetically, or for that time and space. And that's what scares me, though, Jamie, is I don't feel like, as we're now facing the climate crisis is worsening, and the things we see on the news are so overwhelmingly scary, I'm afraid that scarcity, the real scarcity to more and more humans, is going to start being a factor. I like to believe that as the climate news was compelling more and more people in wealthy countries, that they would start to see suffering and make better choices. And of course, farmed animals would benefit. I'm starting to worry that there will be such a profound sense of lack and competition for resources.
And that comes on really nicely to the final question of how does all of that lead you to think about the future? And you've framed it beautifully there, because I think you're right. There is this worry, you know, scarcity makes us worse people. And as we're dragged into the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy and I start to worry about survival and shelter and our family and the real basics, it's very hard for us to be morally expansive. Whereas the flip side of that is, you know, is a real hope, right? If you can imagine what we could do as a species, if we could free all 7.8 billion humans from the mire at the bottom of the Maslow's hierarchy, what that intellectual and emotional and ethical capacity could do for the world could go either way. But and it's how does that leave you thinking about the future? And again, some people here like to go into sort of sci-fi utopian vision or a sci-fi dystopian vision, thinking quite long-term about whether we might end up with a sort of post-scarcity Star Trek future or something much more challenging. Other people like to focus more on sort of pragmatic concerns of the problems we see today, whether that's for non-human animals in farms or in the wild, whether it's the problems of human ethics we see, but also given some of your work, how can we look after our own selves as sentient beings as well? So again, it's a crazily broad question. Where would you like to go on thinking about
that? Personally, what grounds me is I try not to have an expectation of success. I try to let go of the outcome, so to speak, and just say there's absolutely no reason, given the data I saw on the news today, to think that this is working well, but I'm still going to treat every sentient being that I can with the dignity that they deserve, myself included. So that's a spiritual practice for me. That's an ongoing meaning I try to imbue with my actions, is not for the outcome that they will necessarily achieve, but just because it matters to me.
Yeah.
Today again. I love the pragmatic stuff. I love to make a list of the way I think things should start to change now. I think we should all adopt sentientism as our central organizing principle. Seriously. My partner is a brilliant, now is our executive director at the sanctuary, but previously was a social worker and specialized in addiction recovery, so drug and alcohol inpatient therapy. And so she taught me so much about how the systems around a person, the support around them shapes who they are. So I would like to see sentient beings in our legislation as individuals with rights. I would really like to see just that culture of care and an ethics of care brought into, I think, organized religions, for example, schools. I think if we go to institutions and where we already have organization, humans have organized to behave together to achieve more. I think you got to get sentientism in their hands, and we just all need to have a meeting over lunch and update the company's core values to include sentientism, and we're there, right there. Where humans are already so organized in so many places, if we could just update their hardware to include, or the software, but to include sentientism, I think that it could catch on and the idea could spread like wildfire. It just needs a chance. And yeah, I mean, I can see a post-scarcity future. I love that. I think that's important too for some creative types, the right-wing types. I think that's critical that they're creating art. I would think that in that world, we have way more pleasure. All this extra energy that we spend with cognitive dissonance, with toxic shame, with basically engaging in the cycles of preventative harm that are totally not helping any. Think about how much more art and joy and music and the freedom of pleasure. I love to envision a world where we've rewilded so much of the land. We have agroforestry and different like permaculture growing techniques. I think food is central to my future that I envision post-scarcity. Food becomes, and how we grow food and how we celebrate the farmers who are growing food ethically. I think that would be the world I'd like to see. I think we would. I actually have a feeling that I've seen it. I've experienced it personally. I think that we would have a whole new relationship with non-human animals that will blow many people's minds. What I've seen here, we have about 80 previously farmed animals and about 20 cats. So we have a lot of animals here. I engage every day with non-human animals, and it's our privilege. Sarah and I get to spend time with them. They're like our family members. It's amazing what's possible when you switch your relationship to them from superior to fellow earthling. And I think that will bring humans so much more joy that many of us have forgotten. And so I have hope that way. I don't actually see it happening today.
Yeah.
But I do have hope when I listen to your podcast. So thank you.
That's a wonderful vision. And I think everyone's familiar with the concept of, you know, existential dread. And I think you read the news and that's probably what you'll feel, because the news tends to have a pretty negative bias. But you've laid out something that might fit with existential hope. And I think we need to put more effort into a more positive vision of thinking about you know, just how good things can be if we can make actually what are pretty simple, straightforward changes. We've just got to bust through the systems and the psychology and the social norms. And I agree. I think there's so much space for creativity and art and design and aesthetics and multiple different visions of what the future might be like. I think it's really good to be clear about the problems we want to fix and how we want to fix them. But in a way, I think we should be radically open-minded about the sort of potential utopian upsides we might be able to go for as we work through those problems. And you hinted at it already. In a way, we've got so many human problems to work on, and that remains a challenge. But at the same time, it does seem to me like we've made some progress, at least, right? At least conceptually. We've gone from a very tribal approach to one where, at least in concept, after the Second World War, every country signed up to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And we know that's not practically a reality by any means. But at least in concept, most humans would acknowledge theoretically that all humans matter. That's some sort of progress. Do you get the sense that we can just keep doing more of that and expand our scope to sentience, as I've amateurishly tried to do, update the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, update the Sustainable Development Goals, you know, update the company policies, update the laws, and just say, look, let's go from humans to all sentience. Do you think we can do that? Or do you think we need something different to make the leap beyond our own species?
Both and. Absolutely think we need to do that. I think that's critical. I think there are different types of different humans oriented naturally in different ways. And I think that for the more left brain or for the more organized, sequential, logical types of people out there, that legislative piece or that rational approach to how we're going to go about affecting a more positive future for all of us is beyond critical, just absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. But I also think that you can't legislate morality, right? You can't legislate our way into what I think is almost like a spiritual transformation, or just, let's just say, a release of oxytocin when pondering, call that spiritual or alchemical or chemical. That profound conversion, that's what we see when people come to the sanctuary and they spend time with one of the rescued dairy cows. And you can tell them all day that they should be nice to cows, or you can legislate cows as sentient beings. And there could still be an inner developmental delay, so to speak. I shouldn't use that. That sounds so hierarchical. Let's just say there could still be a missing link in their understanding of it's like a hole in their brain. And I see that with my physiotherapy clients. It's like they don't even know that the part of their body that's been injured, that part of their brain is darkened. The neurology stops firing in that area. It looks like a shadow on MRI. So you would literally have a gap, a darkened shadow area.
Literally is a blind spot. It's just something.
Yes. So there's a blind spot where farmed animals should be, or where other groups that you've been deeply indoctrinated to see that type of group as other or less than, or just thing. They don't even exist. Anyway, so we could do that work. We must do that work with the organization and the framework and the legislation. But I think that we need all the systems. We need to take the idea and let each and every group be good at what they're good at, or have their values that they have be respected, and then just be adding sentientism to it, if that makes sense. Be adding a conversion experience where they actually meet a sentient being that they previously didn't see as sentient and recognize it. And I think that helps our sentience too. I think that's just going to make us all more sensitive in the good way.
Yeah, I agree. I think even with a completely narrow human perspective, it would be good for us too to have a more generous moral scope of consideration. Yeah. And even on the non-human moral consideration, I think there is some progress there. It feels to me as though we've gone from maybe a very strongly anthropocentric approach. I think if you go back into older customs and histories, it was actually less anthropocentric, but we've gone through quite a strongly anthropocentric period where non-human animals were completely considered as objects with no moral salience or meaning whatsoever in general terms. And it feels like we are, in a way, we're part winning the moral argument, because I think people now, still in a patronizing anthropocentric way, deigning to grant some consideration to non-human animals. So they'll say, I don't like factory farming, but normal free-range farming is okay. Or of course, it's unpleasant to be cruel to pets. So there's some, but it's still quite patronizing and human-centered in that sort of granting of some grudging consideration, as long as it doesn't inconvenience me too much. But the next step is, I think, what you're laying out, which is just as we're trying to get humans to do for humans that don't look like them or have a different sexuality or have a different background or a different belief system, and say, trying to get them to say, look, just take their perspective, understand what it might be like, however imperfectly, to be one of those people feeling the oppression, feeling the challenge that they have. Just need to do that for non-humans too. And maybe that's a little bit tougher because we do have a species boundary to get over, but we have so much in common evolutionarily, behaviorally, and our most important needs and interests as humans, the things we would say are the most important things, freedom from physical harm, want to keep living, family connections, sustenance, shelter. We share them all, right? So you might struggle to understand the aesthetic, you know, appreciation of a dolphin, but you can absolutely understand what it feels like to, you know, have your children taken away or be physically damaged in some way. So the most important things, I think it's actually really easy to empathize with. And just if we can make that psychological step, we can make some deeply revolutionary changes. And I think you've helped to do what I think we need to do more of, because in a way, that moral argument is really already won. I struggle to find anyone who's got a convincing response or a pushback to that. The challenges all seem to be about human psychology and social norms, and it doesn't mean they're trivial to get rid of. It almost feels like we've won the moral argument. We now need to win the social norm and the human psychology argument. And I think, as you've done, painting more of a positive picture about what that future might look like and planning out how we can actually get there, the time's come to work more on that now. It's not, you know, it's not, we still need to keep complaining about the problems and challenging the problems and being clear about what the problem is. I think we need to put more effort as well into existential hope and just transition roadmaps. So let's lay the path out too. So.
Absolutely. And I think that sentientism will look different depending on where it's practiced.
Yeah.
So to have that openness, to have that, to make it a question that you are living into the answer, as someone once said, not to presume that you have one right way and that this set of behaviors is exactly how we will achieve these great and lofty visions. I know that this is an area I wish to learn much, much more about, but I've read the work of Dr. Margaret Robinson and it inspired me so greatly. She's a native professor of indigenous wisdom. And she said that, of course, indigenous cultures are not a monolith, but for the most part, in indigenous wisdom, this notion that all sentient beings are related, all my relations, is one, maybe you could say, central tenet to many indigenous cultures. But again, maybe then among the humans in those cultures, there was tribalism. So I often ask myself, here I am in America, we hear a lot about the perils of colonization and the need for an evolution, a revolution of providing land back to very oppressed people, and some very horrible things have happened here, and how can we coexist today with more justice? And I often think that sentientism is helpful there as well. We'll be using so much less land if we were practicing sentience for our non-human animal friends, who go back to some of those indigenous ways of knowing and being. Who knows why these horrible generations of suffering had to occur, but one of the things maybe is that there would be less tribalism among humans at that point. And maybe that was one, if we had to look for, I hate to call it a silver lining, but of whatever has brought us here, but we could collaborate and work together more through, think, agroecology or vegan permaculture. But in my mind, that's like sentientism in practice, centered around food and coexistence.
Yeah, and just recognizing what we have in common. And that's not just humanity, that's sentience. And whether we need to shift from humanity to sentientity, which is another clunky term, or, you know, I think that shift in conception can help. I think that will be powerful. I think it's an optimal approach to take a naturalistic approach and a sentiocentric approach. But I think sentientist philosophy and that focusing on sentience can help enhance any worldview, even the supernatural ones too. So just as there are people within the Islamic faith and in Christianity and Catholicism who are actually talking to their own communities and saying, look, we need to drop this dominion idea and move more towards a concept of stewardship, or extending our compassion for non-humans as well. There are active movements within those religions trying to shift that way. There are groups within Buddhism, for example, who are saying, look, we need to go back to ahimsa and take it seriously. Why have so many parts of the Buddhist world drifted away from that and actually become, if you like, maybe more Western and colonial by accepting animal farming and fishing when they clearly go against ahimsa? And I think that also plays into some of the indigenous ways of thinking as well, because while they do have often a reverence for other sentient beings and the wild, of course, many indigenous practices and cultures directly and needlessly harm sentient beings as well. And I think just as any culture and worldview can evolve and improve and cause less harm, I'd hope that ultimately, to the degree they're able, even different types of indigenous worldviews will start to adopt that sensitivity that recognizes, ideally, revering another sentient being doesn't involve harming or killing it. So I think you're right. We don't need everyone to become a sort of strict sentientist and have a totally naturalistic worldview. I think we can also have a broader influence about just pushing this idea of a sentiocentric breadth of compassion that people of any worldview can adopt. And then,
amen.
Cool. Well, it's been a fascinating conversation. It's been great to have a proper conversation with you. We've worked out what's real, what matters, and how to head towards a utopian Star Trek future where we've fixed all the problems. So that's not bad for an hour and a half. So are there any other things you'd like to talk about before we come to wrap up?
We had mentioned before this that you might want to touch base into conspirituality, that awesome work that that group is doing. It might be too much. I would happily just catch you on Facebook if it's too long.
No, I think it would be great to touch on that, because I do think it's interesting. My focus on the naturalistic side of sentientism, many people think it's about, maybe countering some of the warped ethics you see in religions. But it's not just that. It's also, one, it's an intellectual commitment to trying to understand reality accurately. And I think naturalism is the best way of doing that, because almost by definition, anything else is somewhat arbitrary or fabricated. So it's partly just an intellectual thing about, I think naturalism is the best way of imperfectly understanding stuff. And that's a good thing to do. But it is also about how compassionate ethics can be undermined by all sorts of different unfounded beliefs. And some of those can be religious, of course, or supernatural, but some of those can also be of a different nature, right? There can be multi-level marketing organizations, or some of the dodgy stuff that goes on in the wellness industry or alternative medicine. The list goes on of all sorts of different areas. QAnon is another classic one at the moment, where totally unfounded beliefs causing people to warp their ethics and do sometimes awful, dangerous things. So this isn't just a sort of let's find a non-religious ethics. It's also about saying there are all sorts of unfounded beliefs, supernatural or otherwise, that can cause real damage. And one of the topics we touched on when we were talking before is in that world of the spiritual and the yoga world and the related fields around it of human wellness and human well-being. And there's so much good in that space, of course, but it's not immune from unfounded beliefs, fabrications, dangerous human psychology, warping of ethics. And we've seen many instances of even what you might term cultish dangerous behavior as well. And as you said, we share an admiration for the Conspirituality podcast, which really, I think with compassion and empathy, but real insight, given the background of those guys, digs into these issues and helps us try to understand them. Yeah, I'd be fascinated to get your sense of that world and how we can get the ethics better and get it to feel a bit more naturalistic as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks who are feeling displaced, myself, from that dodgy wellness influencer stuff. What has been, and it's not a new phenomenon. It seems to have gotten worse. And I think social media has played a role. But the guru syndrome, the charismatic cult-like leader, as our friends are describing it on that podcast, it's really prevalent here. And it has, unfortunately, mixed with the scary political ideologies that are leading people to spread misinformation at a time when we need to.
And we can add anti-vax into that topic, of course, given what's going on at the moment. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. If you are interested in yoga, if you felt good in a yoga class and you want to get back to it in this difficult time to go for in-person yoga, and you're like, is my yoga teacher a charismatic cult leader? I would honestly say just ask yourself if there was a call for ethics towards sentient beings. If you didn't feel that anywhere in the culture of the studio or in the culture of what that teacher taught you was what was being transferred, if it didn't involve a call for ethical behavior for sentient beings, it's not that maybe you just are more aware of the philosophy of yoga than the teacher. I know many students who felt displaced or hurt when Yogi Bhajan was his name. So there's been some unraveling in our country of some of these gurus, more modern gurus and cult leaders, essentially. And you just have to look, like, was what they were offering you power that came without ethics? And if that was what was for sale, then maybe don't buy it next time. And you're not a bad student for having bought it. It was very carefully packaged, but there's that bypassing once again, where if someone is telling you you can have a spiritual journey and transformation, or you should feel very proud of yourself, but not asking you to behave ethically towards other sentients, then that's the lesson we all need to learn now, I think, in that community, which has really been hurting. I know so many people that have been really hurting.
I
found that when I taught yoga, group yoga classes, if I mentioned ahimsa or if I mentioned animal ethics anywhere, people would pull back or not show up the following week. And I'm just still trying to sort that out, because I think maybe it was not the right time or place. But I found myself feeling like when I give a tour of the farm sanctuary, that feels more like yoga to me than the stretches. So I got to this weird place with it. So I'm just trying to figure that out. But maybe some of your listeners are confused about Yoga Land. And I know I have been, but we're just all doing our best.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that there's a linked theme there, which is, again, part of my challenge about non-naturalistic ways of thinking. One of the things they often do is put someone or something as more important than the suffering of sentient beings. And whether that's a deity, whether it's a church, whether it's a priest, whether it's an imam, whether it's the institution, whether it's even a nationalistic leader who will solve all the world's problems if you only give over all the power, whether it's a cult dynamic, as soon as you sense that there is some superordinate thing that is much more important than the experiences of ordinary sentient beings, I think that's a red flag in whatever field we find it. Yeah, that's good counsel.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. What's the best way of people following you, finding out more about your work, maybe helping out with what you do at Lancaster?
Thank you. Yes, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Jamie. LancasterFarmSanctuary.org or .com, either one. Our email is LancasterFarmSanctuary@gmail.com. If anyone wanted to send us a message, check us out on Instagram, Facebook. We're trying to get on TikTok. It makes me feel old, but it's Lancaster Farm Sanctuary on all the social media platforms. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you, Janina. Take care and stay in touch. And it's great to have you in our Facebook group too, as well, building the community.
I love it. Great.
And hopefully our conversation is nudging a few more people towards a, you know, naturalistic, compassionate way of thinking. So thank you for that.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?